Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome, everybody, back to another recording of the podcast From The Shot. I am here in Sydney with Charles Burr.
Hello. Hey, gang.
And we're delighted to have joining us to enlighten us about everything that's been going on in Old Blighty and the brouhaha, the brulio over the cricket and baseball, Mr. Gideon Haig.
G'day. I'm in Leeds.
It's
a little bit inclement out there, so it'll be classic English conditions for the first morning of the third test.
Well, I think the English, they've got a lot to fight for in this third test. After the first two, I think it's fair to say, where they have lost unceremoniously. The second test for reasons that they continue to raise criticisms and challenges about, and we'll get to that. But before we do, they've lost despite having adopted, like, the ubiquitous word of the series seems to be baseball, which I confess I'd never heard of until the Ashes series. So I don't know how far it actually dates back and when their new Kiwi coach joined them. So perhaps you can just enlighten us a little bit first, Gideon, about baseball and what it says about their form of cricket and about the British psyche at the moment, or the English, let's be clear, the English psyche at the moment.
That's a very big subject. Baseball is relatively straightforward. England went through a sequence under the captaincy of Joe Root and the coaching of Chris Silverwood in which they won one test match in 17. They got absolutely pantsed out here during the Ashes of 2021-22. So when having exhausted all other means of playing cricket and failing conventionally, they decided to succeed unconventionally. So they promoted Ben Stokes to captain. They made Brendan McCullum, former New Zealand captain with a reputation for T20 coaching as their new national coach. And they set out to play a more expansive, more flamboyant version of the game, rather at odds with the kind of English tradition of doer professionalism. And lo and behold, they started to win games because when another team is attacking you, it can be quite confronting. You don't necessarily have a ready solution to such a heterodox approach. So they went through a sequence of being absolutely unbeatable at home and away. And so they were licking their lips at the prospect of facing Australia off in their own conditions, where traditionally they've done pretty well over the last 20 years. And in fact, baseball has had the effect of bringing the two teams closer together. These two test matches have been very close. And one or other thing happening and going the other way in either of these two test matches could have made the difference between Australia leading 2-0 and England leading 2-0. So it's actually been tremendously watchable cricket. The test match at Lord's was fantastic on that last day. That innings by Stokes is just absolutely outstanding. And he is a hugely admirable captain. Obviously, his players would do anything for him. So, look, Australia did... They were shocked initially. They didn't quite know how to respond. You know, they were taken for 393 on the first day of the series, but they've gradually worked their way back just simply by sticking to first principles and playing the game that they want to play. They're a highly skillful, highly experienced, a highly professional team, and they've managed to slow the tempo of the cricket down to a speed that better suits them. So you've got the English trying to tug the game in one direction, England trying to tug the game in another. And that's the essence of Test cricket at its best. It's really dynamic. It's really tactical. Great man-for-man contests and clashes of philosophies, if you like.
I saw one wonderful statistic about the first Test, which was that England scored all of its runs off about 800 balls, and Australia, which scored, you know, one more run, took 1,200 100 balls to do the same thing. So they were playing two different games. But I then had several arguments with English friends who all went, yeah, so that proves England was better. And it's like, but they didn't win. and it sort of feels a little bit like their attitude to Brexit in a way, which is, yeah, well, we did what we wanted to do and we're better. And it's like, but you didn't win with Brexit. you've totally punched yourself in the face with that. Is there a sort of element of self-delusion about baseball that it's sort of, it's all great, but it didn't actually seem to work that well?
Well, the ultimate delusion is this belief that somehow England has a monopoly on the spirit of cricket. Mm. McCullum, one of his public remarks, talked about the England being on a crusade to save Test cricket. And in the aftermath of the Bairstow stumping, both Stokes and McCullum said that they would never want to win a game that way. It would be against the principles of their evangelical mission. So I think there is a sense that England are getting high on their own supply here. Australia have just stuck to doing what they've always done, which is playing hard, committed, fair cricket and not yielding the chip of a bale. It's frustrating at times that the two nations seem to be divided by a common game, but that's the essence of the Ashes. It's one of those areas. It's a kind of a safe space in global cricket relations where the two countries can be as rude about each other as they like. And at the end of the day, you know, a joke's never too far away. It can actually be conducted in a relatively civilized and self-contained manner. Although, I mean, it's been getting pretty tasty over here. It's been as tasty as I can remember. My colleague Peter Lawler, who's just sitting here at the kitchen table, he says hello.
Hello, Peter.
submitted to the interrogation of Piers Morgan the other night. I don't know whether you caught up.
Oh no!
This is sort of meat and drink to English shock jocks.
Oh my god, yes. Well, Piers Morgan has been. I can't think who it was who tweeted that actually Piers Morgan's response to the Bairstow stumping, if anything, elevated our enjoyment of the victory in the Test by that way. And it was, you know, it just kept on giving. So I shall certainly go and look for the footage of Peter being interviewed by Piers. I think about the baseball, and we'll get in more detail to the stumping in a minute, was that a bit like the British or the English, let's be again specific, is that, as you say, Ian, they had started to win. And, you know, a 1-in-17 test was a pretty abysmal record off which to build. But they had started to win. But when they came up against the Australians, who were able to adapt and get their measure and stick to their strategy and their game, the English then didn't seem to be able to adapt. So they seemed sort of stuck in their swashbuckling style and not be able to even move slowly across, you know, the full 5 days to cope with the fact that they weren't getting the results they had hoped to.
I mean, baseball has lost its shock value in some ways. You know, teams have had a year to think about how you're going to address it. And Australia's come up with a very successful plan. They use short bowling at Lord's. They were successful with that. You could tell the English were frustrated with the tempo of the game. They chafed against it, and it caught up with them. And probably that Test match pivoted on that half hour. In the end, I almost think the Bairstow thing was kind of a bit of an addendum to the ascendant in that game, and to kind of blame that dismissal for the final result is a bit of a stretch.
Well, look, a bit of a cop out, really.
Don't underestimate baseball. I think it has been freeing for the English players. I've seen lots of English teams kind of captured by this sort of Iron Maiden of defence and not quite knowing what to do, but sort of regimented, almost regimented in their failure. Everyone plays better when they're playing a more aggressive, more natural,
fluid,
open-ended kind of game. And look, England players, no matter what you may think of them, are very, very talented ball sportsmen. So everyone could sign up for a message like that. It's kind of, it's exciting if you're part of it. I can imagine the atmosphere in that England dressing room is pretty exalted. They're in an elevated state. But sometimes it's difficult to sustain an elevated state over 5 days with the vicissitudes of Test cricket. So you're right, they haven't found a way to rein it in. They haven't found a way to restrain it. They haven't found a way to redirect it, to kind of go around the Australian obstacle. But maybe they'll work that out in this test match.
Yeah, well, look, hopefully they will, although they were reported, I think, as saying that, you know, they hadn't actually been looking at the Australian tactics. They just seemed a bit bamboozled by the fact that they weren't winning. And now, of course, as you rightly point out, they have a scapegoat. They have found themselves a scapegoat for their defeat in the second test, in namely Australia's allegedly unsportsmanlike behaviour by, you know, deploying the rules of the game set by the very ground and club on which they were playing.
I love that. Just,
yeah, I mean, that seems to be like the best point about all of this, the sort of the exemplar of how ludicrous the whole situation is. And I think there's two things really here to discuss. There's, first of all, there is the way, the overall response that first the cricketers and then the commentators and then indeed the British government has had about the stumping itself. But then the way, whatever you may think of the stumping, the way their position was, you know, fatally undermined by the behaviour of the members of the MCC itself.
You just couldn't write this stuff. It's just an absolute joy. And you're absolutely right. Had that dismissal taken place involving any other countries, England versus anyone else, Australia versus anyone else, and if it had taken place anywhere but Lord's, it would have been a squib. It would have been a nothing. It would have passed very quickly. But there's also you know, the fact that this is a very congested summer. Test matches are following very closely on top of one another, which kind of adds a propulsion to the narrative. And now we're segueing straight into the next test. That adds a lot to the febrile atmosphere.
But I think what was interesting, you talking about how the English seem to have adopted this sort of militant sense of stewardship over sportsmanship in cricket and saving the test. But it really kind of came across as more this sort of Edwardian colonial nostalgia for, you know, the nirvana that never existed, really. This, particularly in a world where cricket is so professionalised and is so hyper-competitive. And indeed, the type of cricket that they're playing with this baseball is drawn more from the monetized short-form versions of the game.
Yeah.
So there's these sort of contradictions all over the place, quite apart from the fact that all the Australians did was follow the rules.
So many. And we need to be careful here not to just use the expression, the English. They're far from monolithic in their response. It's kind of a militant minority who kind of scratch each other's sores and egg one another on. I played a game of cricket a couple of days ago with an English team against another English team, and frankly, everyone on both sides said it's completely fair. And I don't know what the MCC members are going on about. I think most sensible people who've played cricket to a decent standard understand that that's completely within the game. They've probably been in club matches where it's taken place. So, you know, it's Piers Morgan is not representative. I mean, surprise, surprise. Piers Morgan is not a representative view in England.
But what do you think then?
These very figures.
But in your article, you mentioned how Khawaja, like when, you know, you're sort of saying, yeah, it's fair enough, like chanting on the ground is just part of the sort of thing.
Yeah.
But actually, the whole problem with Lords is you've got to walk up all these stairs. If you're a player and you've just got out or you're going off for lunch, you've got to walk through the members' area and up the stairs where all the members are. You're literally in stabbing distance of the players. And you say, you know, that is a privilege, right? Like, that's something that... But Khawaja, the only Muslim member of the Australian team, you say was sort of singled out in that booing melee.
Well, he was the one who actually stopped in order to have a word with one member about his language, and it was a terrible look. You know, in the last couple of weeks, a report has been released into English cricket and its accessibility for minorities, its openness to other cultural experiences. And its conclusion, you know, quelle surprise, is that there are elements of racism and classism in I mean, who knew that this could possibly be so? Now, I mean, I think to be absolutely fair, I'm not sure too many other cricket countries would stand up to the same interrogation. There are plenty of barriers to entry for other races and other cultural experiences in other nations. But, you know, to choose this particular week for an empurpled, apoplectic MCC member, with Usman, is just a horrendous look. I mean, obviously, these things are spur of the moment, but so was Alex Carey's act. And that was actually under the pressure of being on the cricket field. The MCC members have got no excuse at all.
Mm. No, they have no excuse. And I must say, I find it extraordinary that the cricketers do have to walk past the members in that kind of way. But more
the only ground in the world where that happens. And it's great. I mean, it's a fantastic thing. If you've ever been in the locker room, you know, to hear
Just on that though, Gideon, I would not be in the long room though, would I? Because I think the only female who has set foot in the long room at all is the late Queen Elizabeth II.
Yeah, there's a friend of mine told me a fantastic story about being in the pavilion the day that happened and hearing, you know, Charters talking to Caldecott and say, yeah, there's a Bally woman in there. And by the other way, yeah, that's the Queen.
So she got kind of honorary male status for the day. I mean, they are now women allowed to be members, but still not allowed in the long room, or has that changed subsequently to setting foot?
I've been in the long room for a while, but I know people who were in the long room on that day, and they said it was horrendous, absolutely horrendous, including MCC members who were mortified by what was going on.
And
couldn't believe how foolish they were.
Who are they? Like, paint a picture. Is it Lord Toppington III, the inbred heir
there's a bit of that, but it's upper middle class. You got to pay an awful lot to become a member.
Mm.
It contains enormous privileges because it's the most venerable ground in the world, and it's got a relatively small capacity.
Didn't Priti Patel pay £45,000?
It's about that. I've heard up to $80,000. It's a bit absurd. If you were going to refilm that Monty Python sketch, upper class twit of the year, the long room would be where you did it.
Now, look, before we let you go, there is, of course, other cricket taking place in England at the moment with the women's team over there. Yep. And they suffered their first defeat in what, like 29 matches or something overnight, which keeps the Ashes alive, albeit probably only for a very short time.
Yeah, spoken like a true Australian there, Joe. Look, I mean, one of the problems, I think, for international women's cricket is that Australia is so strong. It is a dilemma for women's cricket. And the equalising forces that pertain in leagues and associations don't exist. So Australia can just go on being very, very strong and perhaps succeedingly stronger. But England, in their own conditions, are a handy team. They are working their way towards similar levels of professionalism, and it's great that they can compete. It's temporarily bad for Australia, but it's probably good for the women's game.
Mm. Can I ask just about that? Because the way the Ashes are done with the women is that it's a point system, right?
Yeah.
So the T20 counts towards the points of the Ashes. But it can't possibly be an equal number of points, can it? Like losing one T20. So how does it work?
Oh, look, I don't know exactly, but you're right. The test match attracts a premium point ODIs, which are the main form of international women's cricket, commander set number of points, and T20s with a proportional discount.
Right.
But that's simply because test matches are so scarce in women's cricket. You couldn't decide the Ashes in a single test match. It would be quite unfair.
Well, just to finish up then, Gideon, the thing about the test match in the women's test match in England played just recently, it was actually, I think, only the second time that there had been a 5-day test.
Yeah.
And the first time, the third day had been rained out, and that was a standalone test back in 92. So, but it was apparently brilliant. And that fifth day did seem to make all the difference.
Yep.
So do you think that they will be able to go back, or that now we can hope to have five-day tests more generally for women?
Well, I think if there's guaranteed to be an audience, and there is an increasing audience for women's cricket, Joe, if there's a buck in it, then it'll happen. Now, the art of everything in cricket is towards money.
Yeah, so despite the stewardship of the spirit of the game, in the end, the mighty dollar or the pound will be what wins out.
I can tell you that.
Look, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak to us and to our enthusiastic listeners. We're very grateful.
No problem. Thanks, Joe. See you, Charles.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.